Thalassemia is a group of inherited blood disorders that affect the body's ability to create red blood cells. An early pioneer in the field, Sir David Weverell discusses what the disease is, the treatment and associated problems, and his ongoing projects in developing countries.
What motivated you to start studying medicine?
No idea, actually. After an early desire to be a plumber, my father was an industrial chemist, so there was a science in the family, but we just wanted to be a doctor from about the age of four for no apparent reason. Not a very interesting answer to your question, but I'm afraid that's what happened.
And how did you get into academic research rather than clinical medicine?
I trained in medicine in Liverpool, and we had one or two quite outstanding teachers. Our physiology teacher was a man called Rod Gregory, and he used to come out of his laboratory in a filthy lab coat. But he was inspirational in the sense that you could tell he wasn't just teaching the subject, but here was somebody who was making the subject happen. And this came over to a number of us very early, I think. And one or two other people who had a strong research bent in Liverpool, but I think it was somebody like Gregory who probably in those very early days of training just shifted one's kind of aspirations, not away from clinical medicine, because one wants to try to stay in clinical medicine, but at the same time bridge the gap between that and research. But I think the influence of early teachers like that is very important, actually.
You also did a stint in the army.
Yes, that's a long and bizarre story, but I was one of the last people in the late 50s who had to go in to do national service. They let us qualify in medicine first. In fact, they forgot to contact me, so I didn't think it was really... I thought it was a bit embarrassing to remind them that I had to go in the army, so I managed to do a higher degree in medicine in a year before they caught up on me, so I went into the army as a medical specialist, 2 years qualified, and I volunteered to stay in the UK because I hated the thought of being in an aeroplane or snakes or bullets. 2 weeks later, I was on a troop ship for Singapore. I spent first year in Singapore looking after the children's ward in the big military hospital where all the families brought their kids, and then the second year up in North Malaya. That's where I developed my interest in inherited diseases. One of my first patients in Singapore with a little Gurkha baby was profoundly anemic, and nobody could find out why. And after a lot of playing around in the Singapore University labs, we found the child had this strange disease, thalassemia, which was thought to be, in those days anyway, restricted to the Mediterranean. That was my first simple jaunt into research. I just became fascinated with that disease and studied it ever since.
So what is thalassemia?
Well, the word is from kind of two Greek roots, thalassa, the sea, and the emia bit from the blood. It was invented by an American called George Hoyt Whipple, who was a Nobel Prize winner, not for that. And he was a very well-educated chap, but not too educated, like most doctors. The first patients that were recognised with this inherited anemia were all from the Mediterranean, so he wanted a word that combined the sea with the blood, and so thalassemia. And it's an inherited defect in the production of hemoglobin, the red pigment that fills the red cells and carries oxygen. It's inherited in what's called a recessive manner. So you have to inherit a bad gene from both parents, and the parents themselves are hardly affected. They have slightly small red blood cells. And it turns out to be the commonest genetic disease, that's disease due to a single defective gene, in the world population. It's not restricted to the Mediterranean. It occurs right across parts of Africa, the Middle East, Indian subcontinent, and then at very high frequency in East and Southeast Asia. You would wonder really why a bad gene could reach those frequencies. I mean, in some populations, up to, well, for some forms of, there are many forms of thalassemia, but some forms up to 80% of the population carry it. And the reason turns out to be that if you're a carrier, That is, you've just got one defective gene and your blood is almost normal. You are significantly more resistant to the serious effects of malaria. So in any country where malaria decimated huge populations, if you were a carrier, you were a little bit more likely to live long enough to have children. So the gene frequency rose and rose in these populations till it was kind of balanced out by the loss of the genes when in the severely affected children who had one bad gene from each parent. That's why it's so common.
Is it decreasing now with malaria treatment?
Well, because the trouble is, malaria treatment, as you probably know, the current estimate, there's at least 2 million deaths a year from malaria still. And malaria resistance, drug resistance, is a huge problem. If you were to eradicate malaria completely by destroying the mosquito breeding grounds and making everybody sleep under bed nets, and you would gradually reduce the frequency of that gene, but it would take generations. So for practical purposes, it's not going to change very much for the foreseeable future.
How is it treated?
Well, at the moment, the severe forms, if they're not treated, they usually die of just profound anemia in the first year or two of life. So the major form of treatment is regular blood transfusion. By irregular, I mean for life in many of them. There are all sorts of problems that causes, because when you transfuse blood, you pour lots of iron into the body and the body's got no way of getting rid of that iron. So it accumulates and damages the organs. So as well as blood, you have to use drugs for removing the iron. And although it sounds like a ghastly kind of life, in the richer Western countries, many children are able to live and even grow up and have their own children with it. But it's a huge problem for the developing countries. That's a problem I'm trying to tackle at the moment.
How are you trying to tackle it?
2002, I was asked by the World Health Organization to write a report for them on what was called genomics and world health. And my cynical friend said it could be two lines, nothing much in the offing. We did think a lot about these approaches to these diseases in the developing countries. And for many years, I think, going back to the late 70s, I guess, we'd been linked up with hospitals and universities in the developing world to train people, at least to diagnose these and treat these conditions. So in the WHO, World Health Organization parlance, that's called a North-South partnership, North being the rich bit and South being the poor bit. And we had those all over the place. And in some countries like Thailand and parts of India and Middle East, these people who'd been trained set up excellent departments. But in many countries, there's just nothing. So in the report, we suggested that maybe one approach would be developing South-South partnerships. So a country like Thailand with real expertise might link up with, say, Cambodia, where there's nothing, for helping them at least to get some kind of services off the ground. Since I retired, I've been spending a lot of my time trying to develop these partnerships in Asia. But Asia's a big place, so we split it into two bits. So we have one group of partnerships based on the Indian subcontinent and then one based in East and Southeast Asia. We have spent the last 3 years finding, organising this thing and then finding some really good people to help to run it in those countries. And at the moment I'm fundraising to try to get some funding for a pilot study for for 3 years to see if it really works.
What kind of costs are we talking?
Well, it's not awfully expensive to do this. I've been working, for example, as a partner with Sri Lanka for about the last 10 years, and you can do an awful lot in those countries for a small amount of money. I mean, we built a complete new treatment centre in Sri Lanka for these children with thalassemia. I think it cost us about £50,000. Yeah, I think at the moment we could do a pilot study in the Asian network for not much over about 500,000. It would be a 3-year pilot. Does this work? Is it something that we can really sell to the international health community as a way forward for other common genetic diseases, particularly in Africa? Because there's about 200 or 300, at least 200,000 children born each year with sickle cell anemia in Africa, which is very similar. It's a genetic defect of hemoglobin. There's virtually no facilities for them in most countries. So the idea of partnerships, because there are one or two places where they've got real expertise, but you need evidence that it works. So that's what we're trying to do in Asia.
Are you facing much resistance to it?
Not resistance, no. I think the big problem is that these countries are facing huge problems with malnutrition, infectious disease, particularly malaria, and HIV/AIDS is becoming a big problem, as you know, in many Asian countries. And I think their governments look upon these genetic diseases as way down the list of priorities. I mean, in fact, when I first went to Sri Lanka and used to lecture, I mean, people used to get up and say, you know, we can't even get anybody to measure a blood sugar level in diabetes in the whole of this state. You want to rescue these children? Well, you know, why don't you just let them die, kind of thing? So there's always been an approach that they're way down on the priority list. But what's happening in these countries is what they call the epidemiological transition. As conditions improve and they get on top of malnutrition and they get better public health, better drainage, better water, infectious disease declines to some degree. And so children with thalassemia would have died in the past, very early in life, probably just not even recognized, just thought to have died of infection, and now living and presenting for treatment. So the load on the services is increasing all the time.
What will be the major difficulty? Will it be access to the blood transfusion?
Yes, access to blood. The problem is that blood has to be so carefully screened, particularly in the tropics, because as well as the danger of passing on hepatitis and now AIDS, of course you've got bloodborne malaria as a big problem. In one centre in North India, just a year or two ago, about 10% of their children who were getting blood transfusion were getting malaria. In one clinic, because of the difficulty, without a proper transfusion programme, they were using what are called professional donors, you know, guys who would sell their blood for money, very common. And nearly 100% of these children in this clinic were positive for AIDS. So that is a big problem. And then the drugs that you require to remove the excess iron are expensive. And then you've just got the whole ethos of the time that you require to treat children with chronic disease in these enormous clinics of sick kids with infection and so on. So it's a series of problems. And then a bit of government inertia, which is always a problem.
How receptive have the drugs companies been to cooperating?
Well, the major drugs that are required for these children are drugs to remove iron from the body. The best of them is rather difficult to give because they can't take it by mouth and they have to give it by an injection, but not just a straight injection, an injection that lasts for several hours. So they need a little pump. So you can imagine in a country where they often don't have electricity and things like that. These are really quite, you have to get battery-driven pumps and all that. That in itself is a difficulty. And more recently, there have been two new drugs which can be used by mouth, but at least one of them has problems. And the pharmaceutical industry, I think they're just starting to realise there's a big market out there now in Asia, or there will be as more countries develop proper services. You see, the government can't afford to buy drugs. So what happens is that the only people who get them in many of these countries are the few rich ones who can buy them privately. Sri Lanka is still, I think, the only Asian country where the government does provide these drugs. I think they may be starting in Malaysia now. So you've got this awful problem that they can't afford them. I think the companies could do a lot more, actually. I think they could still make a profit and reduce the cost, but not much sign of it happening. That's the real problem, actually. I mean, it's persuading the governments, with all their other problems, to supply these people with drugs. It's a huge problem in many countries. You go to Indonesia or India, you find that it's just a small, lucky group of rich people. In Thailand, the government supply the drugs to people who work for the government only. This is one of the real problems for the future. You can cure the disease by marrow transplant, and that's being set up in one or two of the developing countries now. Good program in India. You've got to have a compatible donor. One of your brothers or sisters has got to be a match, and of course that's, chances of that are 1 in 4. So that's not the answer. It's a partial answer.
Is your pilot project going to provide the drugs then, out of your funding?
Not initially, no. The pilot project, the first objective is to find out how common the problem is in these countries. We know the disease is there in places like Cambodia and Laos and Bangladesh, but we've no idea how common. So the first thing is you've got to define the kind of health burden. We'll be training people to do the screening tests, and second objective is to train clinicians and nurses and counsellors, people who can give advice. And one of the things that, as well as the malaria resistance, the other thing that makes this disease particularly common in the developing countries is cousin marriages. And that's practiced widely in at least about 25% of the countries where these diseases are common. And of course, your chances of having an affected child, if you're a carrier and you marry a relative, because your relative is more likely to be a carrier. And these are very subtle things, because you've got to be so careful about religion and religious views in these countries. The other approach is prevention. And you can diagnose these diseases when the baby's in utero as early as 12 weeks. So in many countries now, they're having screening programs in pregnancy, and couples at risk for having an affected baby are offered prenatal diagnosis, and if they wish to terminate the pregnancy. And in the Mediterranean islands, I mean in Cyprus, the disease is so common that by the 1970s, they calculated that if they were going to treat all their patients, 40% of the adult population would have to become blood donors. And they would be spending at least half their total health budget on this one disease if they did nothing about it. So they started a big education program and then moved to prenatal diagnosis. The births of new cases are very few now. And similarly in Sardinia, where the problem is equally difficult. Some of the Islamic countries are taking this up now. At first there was a lot of concern in the Islamic faith about abortion, which is what it is. The Islamic belief is that a person doesn't become a person until the soul enters the fetus, which is thought to happen at about 14 weeks. So things done earlier than that are acceptable. Of course, the Catholics will have absolutely nothing to do with it, although in the very high-frequency areas in Italy, they have very active prenatal diagnosis programs. But the Buddhists are very much against any form of taking life. And where I work, a lot in Sri Lanka and Thailand, even though there's massive numbers of illegal abortions, abortion is still not acceptable. When the Dalai Lama was here recently, I had the pleasure of meeting him and putting this question to him, both privately and then in public at that meeting when he gave that talk in the Sheltonian. And he was very ambivalent. Yes, of course, any form of taking of life is against the Buddhist philosophy. And then this big smile, but there are always exceptions, of course. It's very interesting, because what's happened in Thailand is that although the Buddhists stick very much to this belief, they've come to some kind of agreement with the doctors that if it's within the doctor's conscience and it's for the benefit of the family, they will not kind of formally object to prenatal diagnosis, even though the government still not legalised, termination of pregnancy. So one's got this kind of programme starting in this rather uncertain kind of atmosphere. But in Sri Lanka, at the moment, there doesn't seem to be much likelihood of a prenatal diagnosis. To put it crudely, and I didn't go into medicine to become a kind of terminator of pregnancy, I think any form of taking of life is, in many senses, completely wrong. On the other hand, if you spend a lot of time with these families and see the kind of joy that brings to them the knowledge that they do now have the, can have the almost certainty of having normal children, because it's one in four each time, each pregnancy is the likelihood of having an affected child, then I think I do find it much easier to accept. And in many ways, for some of these poorer countries, from the financial point of view, it may be the only way forward for the foreseeable future.
So more of a temporary step as you build up?
Well, one hopes that there will be curative approaches to genetic disease in the longer term. I mean, this wonderful phrase, gene therapy, is just around the corner. It's just been just around the corner since the 1980s. And very little progress. Little progress, but not much. And I imagine if it is worked out for thalassemia, that initially it'll be extraordinarily expensive. So I think one's got to be realistic and say, you know, for the foreseeable future, we've got to stick with prevention or competent symptomatic treatment.
You mentioned that you'll be training people in Cambodia, for instance. Will that be experts from Thailand moving to Cambodia and working with existing hospitals or establishing new centres?
Yeah, the part of the various partnerships being established, but that's exactly right. In the first year, we will run a major teaching course for all the kind of partners where there's no expertise. And then we will arrange a series of secondments on a personal basis from these countries for doctors or for nurses or for laboratory people. And then start the kind of major developmental part in the second and third years. And it will exactly that. It'll require just two-way direction all the time. But first of all, them coming to the countries for training, and then there's people with expertise helping them, and then checking all their initial results in their population screening.
Will their secondments also be coming to the UK?
Not in this programme, no. We've got one person from the UK and people from various countries, kind of expert advisory group to help them, but no, because that end of it, in a sense, it's not finished, but the idea of UK attachments training people for the developing countries, we've been doing that for 30 years. That bit's done, as it were. There are enough good people out there now in this field.